we're still going through the prophets. On Sunday, I had hit on, I guess you could say, three major points. Those have just been that when you look through the prophets, you see that they're always hitting on that destruction will come if obedience is not restored to the people. And that's talking about Israel, that's talking about Judah, that's talking about any nation, no matter what. And we can even take that to today. If our nation does not turn back to being obedient as it had been better at earlier on, in, I guess you could say, the past centuries, then sooner or later we will see destruction. We can't say when that destruction will come. We can't, unlike the prophets, we don't have God telling us, look, in such and such time, at such and such point, destruction will come. We don't know when our destruction will come. We don't even know if destruction will come or not. We know that there is one time where every man will have to answer for the way he has lived, but whether the country that is the United States of America will ever no longer exist, we don't know. We can say that from the Bible, we see that it will happen, but we can't be definite and say, yes, it will happen, no, it will not happen. So, the prophets, again, every single one hits on destruction will come if obedience is not restored. Although they all hit on that, then they come to, although destruction is coming, mercy will be restored once again. And we can, again, see from all of them, and I think it's safe to say that every single prophet, at least one time in their book, says, in one form or another, that God will leave a remnant to return to the land. And he does that because not only had he promised Abraham, not only had he promised Isaac, not only has he promised Jacob, not only had he promised David, all very great men that made their mistakes, but all men that were servants of his, he had promised them that their house would stand. We can look to 2 Samuel 12, or chapter 7, verses 12 and 13, where God, through Nathan, tells David that his son would reign upon the throne. Of course, talking about Christ reigning on a, not the literal throne of David, but talking about being the head of the church. So, they say destruction will come if obedience is not restored. They say that even though destruction is coming, mercy will be restored. And then we talked about how in Daniel, the whole book of Daniel, if you were to read through that whole book time and time again, the same point you'll see is that God rules in the nations of men. You can look through there and you see from Daniel 2 into even Daniel chapter 7, chapter 8, so on and so forth, you see that four nations are told, are said, will reign in this order, and then you see, you can look at secular history. And exactly the way God put it is exactly the way they reigned. It went Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome. You look at history, what's it say? Babylon, Persia, or Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome. The whole book of Daniel is telling us and showing us God rules in the nations of men. We can go to Romans chapter 13, where it talks of the government and the Christian. Today, we can still be 100% certain. I'll say we can be 200% certain that God rules in the nations of men. The leader that we've had, the government we have, some have said, well, God can't be ruling anymore. How can God let a vile and perverse government such as ours rule? That's not the point of the subject, but it's just to show that God rules. God puts in place who he sees fit. We can even think of 1 Samuel chapter 8. Judah asks for a king like the nations around them. God gave them exactly that. In the end, you see how it took them to the destruction that every other nation went to. Following along with that, we can look at, as we talked, we can look at Jonah, we can look at Obadiah, Nahum. Most of the books show that God is a just God. So God rules in the nations, and part of that, his ruling in the nations, is that he is a just God. He is not going to be unjust. He's not going to destroy one people who are a good people. He's not going to let a evil nation stand because he's a good God. To start off with, go ahead and go to Obadiah chapter 10 again. Go to Obadiah chapter 1. Obadiah doesn't have 10 books, but it has at least 10 verses. So Obadiah chapter 1 and verse 10. And if someone wouldn't mind reading verses 10 through 15, Obadiah 1, 10 through 15, or you can say Obadiah 10 through 15. Thank you. So what does Obadiah by inspiration say is going to happen to the nation of Edom? That's who's being talked of here, is the nation of Edom. And if you, to understand this, it talks of their brother Jacob. The Edomites came from Esau. Jacob and Esau were brothers. In God's eyes, Esau should have treated Jacob better than he did. He should have treated him as a brother. He didn't. We can see as they're traveling through the wilderness that they wanted to go through the land of Edom. And Edom came out against them and told them, if you step foot on our land, we will attack you. So what is the reason that God says Edom is going to fall? Exactly. Because not only did they take joy in Judah falling, but they took part in it. Instead of just, they weren't just sitting there watching, they were corralling Judah like a bunch of cattle, like a sheepdog cattle sheep. They weren't just sitting far off going, yeah, look at those arrogant Judeans. They're getting what they had coming to them, thinking that their God's so great. No, they were sitting there, and there were those that were, yeah, look at them, they're getting what they deserve. There were others that were, oh, you want to run off this way here, we're going to block your escape. Oh, you want to try to get over here? Nah, we're going to block off your way. They helped Babylon take their brethren into captivity. And God says, because you did that, the same thing's going to happen to you. Go ahead and look on earlier in the book. Go ahead and we're just going to start from verse 1. The vision of Obadiah. Thus saith the Lord God concerning Edom, we have heard a rumor from the Lord, and an ambassador is sent among the heathen. Arise ye, and let us rise up against her in battle. Behold, I have made thee small among the heathen. Thou art greatly despised. The pride of thine heart hath deceived thee, thou that dwellest in the clefts of the rock, whose habitation is high, that saith in his heart, who shall bring me down to the ground? Though thou exalt thyself as the eagle, and though thou set thy nest among the stars, thence will I bring thee down, saith the Lord. If thieves came to thee, if robbers by night, how art thou cut off? Would they not have stolen till they had enough? If the grape gatherers came to thee, would they not leave some grapes? How are the things of Esau searched out? How are his hidden things sought up? All the men of thy confederacy. Notice that again. All the men of thy confederacy. What's a confederacy? Or what is a confederate? What's a confederation? Not exactly. A group. Edom had had an agreement. They had allies that had made a compact with them. Hey, if you don't attack us, we won't attack you. Hey, if you work with us, we'll work with you. Look at that again. All the men of thy confederacy have brought thee even to the border. The men that were at peace with thee have deceived thee and prevailed against thee. They that eat thy bread have laid a wound under thee. There is none understanding in him. Shall I not in that day, saith the Lord, even destroy the wise men out of Edom and understanding out of them out of Esau? So God tells them, the men that you made a pact with, they're going to turn around and stab you in the back. Just as you stabbed your brothers in the back, just as you helped Babylon to take them into captivity, the men that you were depending on to help you are going to turn around and stab you in the back. They're going to leave you out to dry. And only that, but he says, notice it again, verse 5. If thieves came to thee, if robbers by night, how art thou cut off? Would they not have stolen till they had enough? If the grape gatherers come to thee, would they not leave some grapes? If a robber, let's say, just because I'm teaching, if a robber comes to my house, what's he going to do? Is he just going to take a little, or is he going to take as much as he can gather? He's going to take as much as he can. He's not just going to, well, you know what? That looks like that's a bit too expensive. Now he might go, look, that's a bit too big for me to take by myself. But he'll, you know what? I can grab this. Ooh, that looks like that's an expensive watch. I'm going to take that. And then he says, if the grape gatherers came to thee, would they not leave some grapes? Does a person that's gathering grapes, should they purposely leave some grapes? No, they get all of the grapes. Now, for the Old Testament, for the Israelites, they were told to leave portions of their fields for the poor. But this is just talking about a normal grape gatherer. A normal grape gatherer is going to grab all of the grapes that he can. So in this, God is basically telling Esau, you could say telling Edom, look, no matter what, people are going to come in, they're going to destroy you, they're going to destroy your nation, and then they're going to take and plunder all the best that you have. And then it goes on talking of the wise men. Just lost my place. Talking about the wise men out of every nation. I mean, I don't remember when we were talking about this. I think it might have been just Tuesday night. What is the most important thing to most nationalities or to most countries? Their traditions or heritage. You could also say they're smart people. They're people that have helped advance them. You can look at Rome, that Rome revered and they hailed their athletes, but they also took pride in people like, I just went blank on his name, like Aristotle, and people like Plato. Men like those that are considered to be wise have always been looked to. So the wise men of Edom, those that they considered to be the smartest, those that they considered to be of great importance to their nation, were going to be taken and destroyed. As I talked about Sunder, every last vestige of the nation of Edom would be wiped away. And is there a nation of Edom today? No. Now, one thing that I had mixed up on Sunday, the Nabataeans did not come and destroy Edom. What happened is that a nation came in and they forced Edom out of their land, and they went into another place where the Edomites became known as Nabataeans. And as I said, the only mention that the Nabataeans have in the New Testament is talking of Herod, who was a Nabataean. And as I said, that's not a great thing to have about you. Yes, Jack. Thank you, Don. So, does that clear it up for you, Jack? Okay, great. And luckily for Don, he brought up some stuff that I had not remembered, so thank you as well. So, all of this is just God, through Obadiah, telling Edom, I'm going to put it this way. Just as when Rome came and destroyed Jerusalem, they didn't leave anything. God, when it came to Edom, he didn't leave anything. There is not one person today that I know of that has Edomite or Idumean blood in them, because they were completely wiped off the face of the earth. And all of that was because they had mistreated the family of Jacob, their family. So it's going to show God didn't just, oh, well, you know what, Edom, because you don't worship me, I'm just going to destroy you. We can look back to Genesis and where it talks of the Amalekites. I believe it's in Genesis 15. If you read that whole chapter, you'll find it. But God is talking of the Amalekites, and he says that their iniquity is not yet full. The Amalekites they had iniquity on them that God held against them, but they had not stacked up enough iniquity for God to destroy them yet. Now, later in Exodus and on, they would be overthrown by Moses and the people as they're traveling through the wilderness. But that was for a long time after Genesis 15. Because we can even look through here. What is Obadiah doing to Edom? What is Obadiah giving to Edom that they should have listened to? A scolding. When a parent is talking to their child, and they say, look, if you do this, this will happen. Discipline or warning. Obadiah is warning Edom of what's going to come. There was still enough time to where, much like Nineveh had done with Jonah, if Edom had gone, whoa, okay, Obadiah's right, look at what we've done, we need to make things right with God. If they had obeyed God, if they had turned from their current path, then God, being the just God that He is, and being the loving God that He is, He would have given them pardon. They didn't turn, they let their pride keep pushing them further, and just as what happened with Nineveh and Nahum, they were destroyed. Had they obeyed, had they returned to obedience, if they had ever obeyed God, they would not have been destroyed. But they didn't listen. So Obadiah is warning them. Obadiah is giving them the warning that they should have heeded, and they didn't. And because of them not listening to that warning, they were destroyed. And again, talking of parents, I mean, right now Catherine's 2 years old. She understands no. She understands some other things. I mean, I could sit there and I could tell her, Catherine, if you keep on trying to touch the hot stove, it's going to burn you. She doesn't have that mental capacity yet to understand, oh, stove burn. But once she's older, once I catch her doing it when she's 4, 5, and 6, if I tell her, look, if you keep on trying to touch the stove while it's hot, you're going to get burned. I can warn her then because she has the mental capacity to understand. I can warn her about stuff, and if she listens, she's going to be saved grief. Obadiah was trying to save Edom from grief, and they didn't listen to him. So, again, I know I hit on Obadiah. I didn't feel like I did a good enough job with it. Sunday, so I was hitting on it again just to show, one, God has the right, God has the authority to tell nations like Edom what's going to happen to them if they don't obey Him. And then this is also showing the just God using His authority to warn them. Just as we can, again, and I'm not getting off track, Genesis 18, the angels with the second person of the Godhead come to Abraham and they, should I tell Abraham what I'm going to do? And he tells them, I'm going to Sodom and Gomorrah to see if things are as they are. God didn't just go to Sodom and Gomorrah and destroy them because He had heard. He went there to see if things were as they were. When He found out that they weren't as horrible as they were, that's when He brought justice. Because justice has to come after there has been a chance to prove or disprove if justice is needed. We've been talking about Nahum, so go to Nahum as well. Go to Nahum chapter 3. We talked about Jonah and how he went to Nineveh as he was supposed to. He didn't want to. He wanted Nineveh to suffer the punishment that God had promised them. But he went, they listened, and the just God, as He had promised them, gave them more time. We come to Nineveh, or we come to Nahum. Nineveh has turned back to their way, and justice is being brought upon them. If someone wouldn't mind reading Nahum chapter 3, verses 1 through 3. Nahum 3, 1 through 3. Thank you. Would you mind also reading just to verse 7? Thank you. So we come to Nahum. Jonah had gone to Nineveh with a warning, and unlike Edom, Nineveh had obeyed. They had put on sackcloth. They had mourned what they had done. I don't remember exactly how long after Jonah, Nahum takes place, but we see that they had gone back to their former estate. And now, because they have gone back to that, Nahum's telling them, justice is coming. The just God has given them the time to repent. They had repented. And just as we can look at 2 Peter chapter 2, verses 20 through 22, talking of a dog returning to his own vomit, such is one that obeys the truth and then falls back away from it. They knew what was right and they decided not to do it, and they received punishment. Does anyone know why, when it's talking of Nineveh, it talks of the bloody city? I know we've talked about this in the past. This is something that both Babylon and Assyria had in common. Some of the ways that they would treat their the nations that they took over were truly bloody. I'm not going to go into great detail, but some of their torture methods basically would make, you could say, death by firing squad, the electric square. They would make those two forms of capital punishment look tame. It's called a bloody city because, just like Babylon, Assyria had overstepped its bounds. God had, you could say, commissioned them to take over Israel. They took over Israel, but then they went beyond that. They basically took joy in the pain that they could cause other nations. We look at Babylon, they were the same way. They acted in the same manner. They would torture and kill people for the fun of it. God hadn't commissioned them to take joy in killing others. So when it talks of the bloody city, it's literally meaning bloody city. As in, they enjoyed hurting others. They enjoyed being able to cause people pain and them not being able to do anything about it. Look at verse 7. And it shall come to pass that all they that look upon thee shall flee from thee and say, Nineveh is laid waste. Who will bemoan her? Whence shall I seek comforters for thee? When we talk about something being laid waste, what do we mean? Desolate. It's destroyed. When you look at how Babylon took over Nineveh, took over the kingdom, the nation of Assyria, they laid waste to it. If I can remember correctly, it didn't even take Babylon a decade. It took them, I'm going to say, at the most, 5 years to completely take over the nation of Assyria. And for a time like this, taking out a nation as strong as Assyria in 5 years or less, that is speedy and that is, to put it simply, that is amazing. Babylon had that kind of power that they laid waste to a nation as strong as Assyria. God had told them, because of what you've done, because of all the things you've done, another nation will come in and destroy you. He warned them. They listened once. He warned them again, and they fell. Again, Nahum, the entire book, is talking of Nineveh and how the just God will punish them for their injustice, for overstepping his bounds. Go to Habakkuk now. Go to Habakkuk. When we come to Habakkuk, this is Habakkuk, who is a prophet. This is, you could say, his conversation with God. Habakkuk, being one of God's children, he doesn't understand why God could let his people be destroyed. He doesn't understand how he could let someone as vile as the Babylonians, or in this book, the Chaldeans, he doesn't understand how he could let someone so vile destroy someone who was more righteous than they were. Just go ahead and start in chapter 1. The burden which Habakkuk the prophet did see. O Lord, how long shall I cry, and thou wilt not hear, even cry out unto thee of violence, and thou wilt not save? Why dost thou show me iniquity, and cause me to behold grievance? For spoiling and violence are before me, and there are that raise up strife and contention. Therefore the law is slack, and judgment doth never go forth. For the wicked doth compass about the righteous, therefore wrong judgment behold. in the first four verses, this is Habakkuk talking to God. Habakkuk, you could say, just tells God, look, law has been thrown out the window. The righteous are not taken care of. Because your law has been thrown out the window, the sinful prevail. That's what he means when he says, therefore the law is slacked, and judgment doth never go forth. For the wicked doth compass about the righteous. Therefore wrong judgment proceedeth. He's basically saying that God has let that which is against his nature take place. Look at verse 5. Behold, ye among the heathen that regard and wonder marvelously, for I will work a work in your days which ye will not believe, though it be told you. This is God talking now. God tells Habakkuk, look, I'm going to let something happen, and I'm going to tell you it, and you're not going to believe it. Continue. For lo, I raise up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation, which shall march through the breadth of the land to possess the dwelling places that are not theirs. They are terrible and dreadful. Their judgment and their dignity shall proceed of themselves. Their horses also are swifter than the leopards, and are more fierce than the evening wolves. And their horsemen shall spread themselves, and their horsemen shall come from far. They shall fly as the eagle that hasteth to eat. They shall come all for violence. Their faces shall suck up as the east wind, and they shall gather the captivity as the sand. And they shall scoff at the kings, and the princes shall be a scorn unto them. They shall deride every stronghold, for they shall heap dust and take it. Then shall his mind change, and he shall pass over and offend, imputing this his power unto his God. So, God tells Habakkuk what's going to happen. Starting at verse 12, it comes back to Habakkuk replying to God. Art thou not from everlasting, O my God? Mine Holy One, we shall not die. O Lord, thou hast ordained them for judgment, and O mighty God, thou hast established them for correction. Thou art of purer eyes than to behold evil, and canst not look on iniquity. Wherefore lookest thou upon them that deal treacherously, and holdest thy tongue when the wicked devoureth the man that is more righteous than he? What has Habakkuk just admitted? Look at verse 13 again. Thou art of purer eyes than to behold evil, and canst not look on iniquity. In verse 13 he says, God, I understand your ways are pure. I understand your ways are right. This is going to happen because of the iniquity of your people. But then he goes on to say, what I don't understand is how you can let such a nation that is so full of sin, so vile, as the Chaldeans take over your people who are more righteous than the Chaldeans. And that's what he means when he says that thou dealest treacherously and holdest thy tongue when the wicked devoureth the man that is more righteous than he. When Habakkuk's looking at it, he sees that the children of God are more righteous than the Chaldeans, so he can't understand how a just God, how a righteous God, can allow such an unrighteous people to take over a people that is more righteous than them. And makest men as the fishes of the sea, starting at verse 14, as the creeping things that have no ruler over them. They take up all of them with the angle. They catch them in their net and gather them in their drag. Therefore they rejoice and are glad. Therefore they sacrifice unto their net and burn incense unto their drag, because by them their portion is fat, and their meat plenteous. Shall they therefore empty their net, and not spare continually to slay the nations? Here Habakkuk is, I guess you could say, using personification, talking of the Chaldeans, talking of Babylonian, and how they treat the nations. When you look at Babylon, they took over every nation that was considered part of the Assyrian nation, and then they took over more than that. So they basically had their net over the nations. When he talks of, shall they therefore empty their nets and not spare continually to slay the nations? They went through pillaging and plundering every nation they took over. chapter 2, I will stand upon my watch, Habakkuk talking, I will stand upon my watch and set me upon the tower and will watch to see what he will say unto me and what I shall answer when I am reported. So Habakkuk is saying, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to stand, I'm going to wait for what God tells me, and then I'll reply to him. And the Lord answered me and said, write the vision and make it plain upon tables, that he may run that readeth it. For the vision is yet for an appointed time, but at the end it shall speak and not lie, though it tarry. Wait for it, because it will surely come, it will not tarry. Behold, his son, or his soul, which is lifted up, is not upright in him. But the just shall live by his faith. He also, because he transgresseth by wine, he is a proud man, neither keepeth at home, who enlargeth his desire as hell, and is as death, and cannot be satisfied, but gathereth unto him all nations, and heapeth unto him all people. Shall not all these take up a parable against him, and a taunting proverb against him, and say, woe to him that increaseth that which is not his, how long, and to him that ladeth himself with thick clay? Shall they not rise up suddenly that shall bite thee, and awake that shall vex thee, and thou shalt be for booties unto them? Because thou hast spoiled many nations, all the remnant of the people shall spoil thee, because of men's blood, and for the violence of the land, of the city, and of all that dwell therein. Woe to him that coveteth an evil covetousness to his house, that he may set his nest on high, that he may be delivered from the power of evil. Thou hast consulted shame to thy house by cutting off many people, and hast sinned against thy soul. For the stone shall cry out of the wall, and the beam out of the timber shall answer it. Woe to him that buildeth a town with blood, and establisheth a city by iniquity. Behold, is it not of the Lord of hosts, that the people shall labor in the very fire, and the people shall weary themselves for very vanity? For the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord, as the waters cover the sea. Woe unto him that giveth his neighbor drink, that puttest thy bottle to him, and makest him drunken, also that thou mayest look on their nakedness. Thou art filled with shame for glory. Drink thou also, and let thy foreskin be uncovered. The cup of the Lord's right hand shall be turned unto thee, and shameful spewing shall be on thy glory. For the violence of Lebanon shall cover thee, and the spoil of beasts which made them afraid, because of men's blood, and for the violence of the land, of the city, and of all that dwell therein. What is the vision that God is giving Habakkuk at this time? What, pronouncing woes on who? Who has God just told Habakkuk that he's going to use as a tool to punish Judah? The Chaldeans. Babylon. So, God told Habakkuk, I'm going to use this sinful nation to bring punishment upon my people. Habakkuk says, I can't understand how a righteous and loving God could use such a unrighteous nation to destroy your children. And God says, don't worry about that. Don't worry about why they're unrighteous. Because of their unrighteousness, they're going to receive their own just punishment. And that's what he's showing in the rest of chapter 2, is he's saying, because they treated the nations as they did, because they were a bloody people, because of all the things they've done, and because they're going to overstep my divine will for them, look at verse 16. Because of all these things, the cup of the Lord's right hand shall be turned unto thee, unto Babylon, unto the Chaldeans, and shameful spewing shall be on thy glory. When we talk about the right hand of God, or when it talks about the cup of the Lord's right hand, that's talking about a cup of wrath, a cup of anger. And when it talks about the right hand, that was normally the sword hand. So the Lord's right hand of punishment was going to come upon Babylon. Why? Because they were an unrighteous nation. He had used an unrighteous nation to bring punishment, just punishment, upon another unrighteous nation. And then because of that unrighteous nation's unrighteous actions, he would use another unrighteous nation to bring justice upon them. So, the prophets, another lesson we can take from them, is that a just God will bring justice upon those who need it, who have earned it. Now, some will sit here and they will think, well, that's the God of the Old Testament. They'll sit there and they'll get confused. Well, the God of the New Testament is a loving God. Go to 2 Thessalonians, and we'll go ahead and end there. 2 Thessalonians. Notice verses 7 and 8. 2 Thessalonians 1, 7 and 8. And to you who are troubled, rest with us, when the Lord Jesus shall be revealed from heaven with his mighty angels, in flaming fire, taking vengeance on them that know not God, and that obey not the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ. What is Paul telling the Thessalonians? A just God is going to come back. And when he comes back, he's going to be justice for those that have not obeyed him. The prophets talk about a just God bringing justice upon the unrighteous. And Paul, here in 2 Thessalonians and many other places, talks of the just God who, using his righteous judge, will bring justice upon the unrighteous. Rick will be back Sunday. I don't know where he'll pick up. Since I haven't really followed yes. When I said that we'll use his righteous judge, yes. Christ, when you can look at John chapter 5 and it talks of righteous judgment, and you can take that with Acts 17 verses 30 and 31. When you look at Acts 17, verses 30 and 31, it basically says that the times of these ignorance, the time where in the Old Testament men sinned and it seemed that they were not punished for that. It says that these times God winked at. And then it goes on talking of the righteous judge. There he's meaning that the reason that all those things took place is because God had not brought his righteous judge yet. Now God's righteous judge has lived. He's been here. He's walked as a man, so now his righteous judge can judge men. And instead of men being able to say, well, God, you don't understand what it's like to be a human, to walk on this earth. God's righteous judge can say, I walked as a man. I've lived as a man. I was able to live according to God's will. Therefore, I can judge you from the aspect of being God, and I can judge you from the aspect of living as a man. So Christ is God's righteous judge who will judge us not only according to God's will, but also judge us understanding what it's like to be a human.